I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The news is filled with stories about professional athletes behaving badly, using performance-enhancing drugs, committing crimes, using racial slurs. We've all seen those disturbing YouTube videos of coaches screaming at their players, and then their owners and commissioners who mete out puny punishments. There's more. Lucrative college programs that shortchange their student-athletes and the damaging concussions in contact sports that have been associated with brain damage, even suicide. We enjoy sports at Radio Times, and all of this got us thinking about some of the ethical challenges of being a sports fan. Can we overlook what's wrong while cheering on our team or favorite athlete? Should we expect athletes to be role models? Is sports a reflection of the good and bad in society or something more? We have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Art Kaplan is a professor, founding head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center in New York City. Served as an advisor to the International Olympic Committee and other sports bodies. He's published widely on the role of ethics in sports. And Art Kaplan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Howard Bryant. He wrote a book called The Last Hero, a biography of Hank Aaron, or Henry Aaron, a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, has served as sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday since 2006. And Howard Bryant, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Howard, let me begin with you. Is sports, do you think, worse today than it was in a generation or two ago?
Well, I think it's worse in many ways, but I think what's really the difference is there's so much more visibility. There's nowhere to go. I think the relationship between the ball clubs, the players, and media and the public is very different today than it was even 20 years ago. I think the relationship between the player and the public certainly is different, especially with social media, in terms of a lot of players trying to bypass traditional routes to the public, newspapers, television, etc. But I think the biggest difference is that it's simply a more complicated society with more complicated issues, with far more money at stake, far more revenues at stake, and it's made the relationship between the fan and the game that they love very, very different and very conflicted in a lot of ways.
Well, I want to pick up on everything that you just said, Howard Bryant. Let me give Art Kaplan a chance to weigh in as well. And Howard talked about social media, and there is so much less privacy today. Do you think that has affected the fan-athlete relationship?
Absolutely. I think Howard's absolutely right. You have fewer screens, fewer opportunities to say, hey, I'm not sure I really said that. Now it's all on YouTube, or you tweeted it directly out to your followers. So the sort of public face of the athlete or the coach, or for that matter the owner, if you think about some of the owners who are social media users too, it's much more like a sieve. And so that gets people in trouble. I certainly know back in the 50s, some of the antics of professional athletes were not reported on by sports writers who were kind of acting as censors in a way, and not
sure
telling us about their drinking and their sex lives and whatever racist views they held and so forth. That's not true today. The athlete may tell us themselves, and then I'd echo what was said too about money.
Mm-hmm.
The money involved has just gotten enormous. It's crazy. You're talking about an industry that we tend to think of as sport and sort of secondary. I got interested in it because it's such a huge part of our lives, and it's such a huge business.
Well, in fact, Howard, you've written a lot about that, about how money has just changed the games. We're talking about, in many ways, just millionaires, maybe even billionaires, who are part of this sports industry.
Sure. Well, to go back to something that Art said, I mean, think about what's happening in Philadelphia right now. You've got Riley Cooper embroiled in trying to make nice with his teammates after making a racial slur on video at a Kenny Chesney concert. And I was about to do our show, The Sports Reporters, a couple of days after it happened. And one of the conversations that we were having in the green room was, everybody's got a camera.
Right.
I mean, this wasn't something that he had said on a broadcast or that he had gotten in trouble for that ended up in some sort of paper trail in a police report or something like that. He was at a concert, and somebody about waist high, then maybe chest high, suddenly started filming. And when that starts happening, all bets are off. But the money has changed everything, and it's been changing for years anyway. I believe as late as the mid-1960s, the average baseball player was earning 7 times the average American worker's salary. Today, it's almost 100 times that.
Wow.
To jump in, you remember, some listeners will be shocked at this, NFL players all had second jobs.
Well, they all and the baseball players did too. And Hank Aaron used to tell me he used to, he sold insurance and one year, and then another year, he was working in a liquor store, and there was just all kinds of that connection. And the other part of it too, in terms of the relationship, is that the players themselves were part of the community. And this is not nostalgia. This was an economic reality.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't making $200 million, so your kids were going to public schools. And that changes everything. When you're that distant and that closed off from the society, what it creates in a lot of ways is obviously an entitlement, because we are run and governed by money. And as we always say in the clubhouse, the smartest guy in the room is the one with the biggest number of zeros on his paycheck. But the other thing that it creates secondarily is unbelievable resentment. So you've got this relationship between player and fan, where the fan is connected to the player and the team, yet deep down resents them for the salaries they make. And the writers in a lot of ways are similar. And you have this blogosphere now where you've got an incredibly democratic writing universe where everyone's got a blog, or people can communicate online and they can say their piece. It's not just an ivory tower media anymore. And that creates this cauldron where people are actively looking to watch you go down. They're waiting for you to fail. And it's a strange dynamic, because on the one hand, we got up the athletes, and on the other hand, when Riley Cooper does what he does, or when Mike Rice at Rutgers does what he does, the price for that is to expect them to lose everything. You lose your career, you lose your dignity, you lose it all.
Well, let me just pick up again on what you both have said, and I'll toss this back to you, Art, but maybe this is taking athletes off their pedestal, and it seems to me that no human being should ever be put or live on a pedestal.
Well, there was a famous quote many years ago, I'll paraphrase it, Charles Barkley said, you know, I'm not your role model. Your role model is your teacher or your father or someone. Don't look to me that way. But I noticed just this week the Pope met with a group of soccer players in the Vatican. They're having a friendly match between Italy and Argentina. I don't think anybody asked the Pope who he's going to root for. You may remember he's from Argentina, but
exactly.
I think he has an Italian connection. But anyway, he said, look, you guys are role models, and you have to take that into account, and being a prominent athlete is a social responsibility. I think society likes to look to athletes to set examples, to be virtuous, to be heroes. Like it or not, we do put them on pedestals. There is a, whether the athlete wants to do it or, you know, whether it makes any sense in terms of they're just human beings that are very fallible, there is this, you know, a long history of children's books and writing about the virtuous, heroic athlete. So when they fail, or when they cheat using performance-enhancing drugs, it really is quite a tumble, because in a way they are kind of viewed as our moral exemplars of a sort. I'm tempted to add, God help us, but yeah,
well,
there they are.
Well, Howard, and just picking up and then going back to you, but does that raise questions for you about the psychology of fans? I can understand how an 8 or a 10-year-old boy or girl could be, you know, a huge sports fan of a particular figure, but you know, fan means fanatic, right?
Yeah, and when you get a little older, you should know better, right?
Well, that's sort of what I'm asking you, but go ahead.
Well, I think there's a couple of things here that really, I mean, that I've always had problems with. I think the number one thing, and I've been dealing with this up here in Massachusetts with the New England Patriots and the Aaron Hernandez murder case, is that there's this question about what you owe as a sports team and about what the athlete owes the public. And up here in Massachusetts, the argument, because the Patriots are so beloved, because Bill Belichick bizarrely is so beloved, and because Tom Brady is so beloved as a player, that there's been this huge backlash that the team doesn't owe the public anything.
Wow.
And I have a problem with this based on two things, and Art was talking about it earlier. One, professional sports, going back to Babe Ruth, has sold itself as virtuous. That sports are good for you is a huge part of their billion-dollar industry. You don't talk about Prince or Madonna or Bruno Mars being good for you or Tom Hanks being good for you. They're actors, they're entertainers, and people expect rock and rollers to do drugs. They don't really do that with ball players. Ball players are somehow supposed to be set apart. That it's almost like with the president's, you know, fitness sort of dynamic where being healthy and being an athlete is good for you, which is good for us, which is good for us as a country. And that creates this role model thing that is not necessarily true in an age of performance enhancers, in an age of $100 million contracts, in an age of extremely complicated finances. But yet these two dynamics exist. So on the one hand, you've got Tom Brady and Donovan McNabb and Michael Vick and all of these players with their charities and their golf tournaments and all of that. And then on the other hand, when they do something that goes against that, then the next thing that happens is that they want to be separate from it. So it's almost like trying to have it both ways. I've always kind of felt that at some point, the fan has to be smart enough, the writers and the media have to be smart enough to begin a dissolution of that dynamic. But what comes with that dissolution is lots of money.
Mm.
Because players and teams, they get tax breaks. They get special dispensation for this notion that they are good for the community. And the entire sports dynamic begins to collapse when you start to really attack these ethical issues, because on the one hand, you'll have players, I mean, players have told me for years, why doesn't anybody else complain that Halle Berry makes $20 million per picture, but everybody gets mad at the money that I make? And how come when Sylvester Stallone gets busted for having human growth hormone when he's trying to make a movie, no one says anything, but I get busted for using HGH, and I'm the jerk? And I said, well, because your industry has sold your purity as part of its business.
Well, you know what? We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Art, I'm sure you want to respond to what Howard Bryant just said. We're talking about some of the ethical challenges of being a sports fan, and we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Howard Bryant, author of The Last Hero, a biography of Henry Aaron, is a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, and has been a sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition. Saturday, Arthur Kaplan, professor and founding head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center in New York City, and he has been an advisor to the IOC and other sports bodies, written widely about the ethics of sports. Much more after this short break. We've got calls coming in. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents the Richard Thompson Electric Trio, Todd Rundgren, the David Bromberg Quintet, the Mavericks, Asleep at the Wheel, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 15th through 18th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, it's been a staple of summer since James Dean lit up the screen. We'll look at teen romance films, including The Spectacular Now.
You wouldn't know who I am.
I know you. I'm
Amy.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Howard Bryant and Art Kaplan about the ethics or the ethical challenges of being a sports fan. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Art, let me go back to you and a piece that you wrote recently about the moral rot, using your word, in the NFL. And you raised some questions about Aaron Hernandez, who's been charged with the murder of Odin Lloyd. What are we supposed to make of this allegation, I guess, this potential crime?
Well, what I was griping about was my own personal moral dilemma. I like football. I played football. I enjoy watching the pros and college football and even high school. And at the same time, you've got this game that is now full of athletes doing bad things. Hernandez at the far extreme, Cooper with the racist rant, but lots of, you know, there's been a continuous sort of drumbeat of moral failure of athletes, either domestic abuse. We've had other situations where pro players have been involved in homicides. It's out of proportion to what you'd expect in a group of young men with that kind of money. You've got all this information coming out about the harm of football. We'd all have heard about the concussion dilemma, and you've got NFL retired players suing the league saying, we're damaged, and you knew it, and you didn't do anything about it. The commissioner of football is saying, well, you know, we're going to study brain damage and work to find out what we can do to reduce this, but in the meantime, can I really say, yeah, if you're entering high school and your child asks you to play football, would you sign the permission slip, knowing that no one knows right now today how to prevent that damage? Marty, you may remember we had a suicide at the University of Pennsylvania.
Indeed,
one of the football players, which was attributed to, or many believe is linked to, brain damage. So the question is, yeah, I like football. I, even though I'm not in Philly anymore, I remain an Eagles fan.
Sorry to hear about that.
Well, it's, you know, my moral failure.
I understand.
But
we feel your pain.
At the same time, if I think of myself as someone who tries to advance ethics,
right,
tries to think a lot about morality, is this a sport that in good conscience I could root for?
Well, I mean, I think your argument, I mean, the answer to that question seems to be no, based on your own argument.
And I lean that way, too, although I have to say, you know, there are many things I think I'm weak morally, but I still do them. But
exactly.
And this may fall into that category.
Yeah, go ahead, Howard.
This is exactly the conversation, and we deal with it all the time. I get letters from fans all the time saying, hey, listen, these guys know what they're getting into. Nobody's putting a gun to their head to play football. They know the risks, and now you want us to feel sorry for them because they got to make all this money and they got all this glory, and now they're damaged. Back about 10 years ago, OSHA did a fantastic report on the effects of football on the body because they considered it to be a workplace safety issue.
Wow.
And they had concluded at one point, I believe, that the average life expectancy for an offensive lineman was 59 and a half years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the average couch potato watching the game, who's eating all kinds of fatty foods and doing and smoking and doing whatever they're doing, may actually live 15 to 20 years longer than the guy who's on the field playing the game. And it, you know, it brings up a really interesting question. It's the deal that I think fans have made. It's very, very hard. I go through this myself. I grew up a Patriots fan. I went to Temple University. I've watched the Eagles many, many times and the whole thing. And you watch this game and you watch these kids essentially being thrown into this. There's no way out. You go into this, your bodies are broken, and when you go down, the line in football is next man up. I mean, that shows you how disposable the players are. And I think what's really weird about it, too, as a fan, when you're watching this, is that you see it. You see those hits, and the players are so big and so fast. And the game itself, and ESPN, we'd always been guilty of it a few years ago. We had a segment in the program called Jacked Up, where guys, you know, we would run clips of the most vicious, devastating hits, and we would say, you got jacked up. And then now with the concussions and everything, it's gone away. But I ask people all the time, and Art, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Do you watch the game for the skill? Do you watch the games for the hits? And if football began to find ways to reduce and get rid of the hits, would you still watch the game? Me, personally, I watch the game for speed and skill and the fun of that. But a lot of people I talk to, and I just do these anecdotal kind of surveys, they say, without the hits, I'm not watching the game. That's part of it.
And do you think hockey is part of that as well?
And I was going to say, and let's not isolate the NFL, because hockey, not only are you moving almost as quickly as you are on a football field, but you also are on skates and you have a weapon. And so,
and it's also a sport that tolerates fighting.
That's exactly right.
Right, fighting, which
that's exactly
certainly
right.
Wouldn't be tolerated if people weren't, you know, if a league believed that they could get rid of it without losing the fan base. And I'll answer your question. I watch it too for the skill side. I'm not. I cringe at the big hits, but we all know that if you listen to sports talk radio, if you talk to people at the games, huge percentage of people are there for the big hits.
They watch it for the hits, absolutely.
Yeah.
I've always said, when we've talked about reform in football, in fact, they're going through this in D.C. right now with Robert Griffin III and this great master plan to protect him. I said, how can you protect him? There's only one way you can protect a football player, and that's to have him not play. The problem with football is football. And if you're going to play this game, everybody makes a deal. The player makes a deal that they are going to risk their lives and livelihood to play this game. The fan makes a deal that this is going to be their entertainment, and they're going to kind of turn away from some of the tougher parts of it. I remember talking to Chris Carter about this, who used to play for the Eagles, just inducted into the Hall of Fame. We did a program not too long ago during the concussion issue when it was at its height. And I said to him, Chris, knowing everything you know, knowing that this game is going to take 20 years off of your life, would you still do it? And he said, absolutely, and here's the reason why. Because my 60 years on this earth, by being a football player and all that comes with it, are going to be better than your 80, not having what I have.
That's fascinating.
And I said, call me on your 59th birthday.
Let me jump in with just
go ahead, Art.
An appendix on that. We have a project now at NYU on sports and society, and we had a meeting, and I had a chance to talk to Harry Carson.
Sure.
Power to know him, the former All-Pro Giants linebacker, great, great athlete. I asked him, would you let your son play? And he said no.
But so are we talking, Art, about, I mean, essentially gladiators and a Colosseum and the crowd, you know, roaring thumbs up or thumbs down? Is that what we're talking about?
When I sit in the stadium, I think about that all the time, that we haven't really traveled that far from the Coliseum now. Happily, in the old Coliseum, you know, nobody but a few left alive. Here, we're doing somewhat better in terms of the damage and the toil, but it's still there. And as Howard and I have said, there are a lot of people there. You know, it's like going to NASCAR races. You're waiting for the crash. There's a lot of people there to see the big hit. I remember a couple of times when people were seriously injured, fans in Philly and elsewhere cheering. You know, that was the old Michael Irvin event.
Yeah, Michael Irvin ended his career there.
Game. I would say not the Coliseum, but the Coliseum Junior.
Coliseum Junior.
Yeah.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. We got a lot of callers that want to join our conversation. We are talking about the ethical quandaries of being a sports fan, talking with Arthur Kaplan. Art Kaplan, professor, founding head of the Division of Bioethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center in New York City, used to be here in Philadelphia at Penn. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN The Magazine. And let's see what Patrick from Winmore has to say. Patrick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm kind of jumping back, I guess, to something you said earlier about whether sports was a reflection of society. And when Howard was talking about Hank Aaron selling insurance or working in a liquor store and kind of being part of the community, and athletes not doing that today, I think that's part and parcel of a society where we have a lot more rich people and a lot more poor people and not a lot of interdependence. You know, it's sort of the gated community didn't exist 40 years ago. And now I think you know, the gated community is where you're going to find most of the professional athletes.
Well, Patrick, that's a fascinating comment. Howard, do you want to respond to that?
He's 100% right. And I whenever I try to talk about exactly what Patrick is talking about, I refer to it as they live behind the tinted windows mm-hmm. of their Escalades. They're not part of this anymore. A lot of the players at Fenway Park, where they play for the Red Sox, they live in some of the condos that are walking distance to Fenway, and they drive to the ballpark, so nobody can see them, and nobody can interact with them. They may sign a couple of autographs, walk into their cars, but for the most part, they are separate from us.
Art, do you think, and getting back to the fan, and I think something both of you said earlier, that this kind of separation, even almost segregation of wealthy athletes creates both resentment but also adoration?
Yeah, I think it is absolutely that kind of a split, Marty. I think people say, I want my kid to make it to the NFL, the NBA, to enjoy those riches, what a success, or even just to get the college scholarship, that would be great for many. And on the other hand, you've got people saying, this guy broke his leg, or this guy got into trouble, or the coach cut him, I don't care. He's so far distant from me, I can't even identify with him as a person. I identify with him as a jersey, or as a name like the Eagles or something. So I do think that split is there. I think at the same time, one other angle comes into this in terms of identifying with athletes and so on. They are omnipresent now in the media. I'm trying to think back when I was in high school and college, I read the sports page. It probably is, for better or worse, where I learned to write. I had sports writers that I admired, and I grew up in Boston, read the Boston Globe, and paid attention to some of the New York guys. But that was it. It was kind of print, and the news came. Today, you may not see this guy in your neighborhood, and you may not find him, you know, running the hamburger joint in town as in my day, but boy, are they in your face. How many cable networks do we have 24/7? Just sports and talk radio, sports and games and exhibitions on all the time. So in another sense, it's inescapable at this point. No wonder we muse about their moral failures.
Howard, it's all ESPN's fault.
you could make an argument. I mean, but that's what we've become. And believe me, we all have our inner conflicts about our role in it as well, from the entertainment side of it, the relationship with the athletes, the relationships with the leagues, the relationship between it and journalism and traditional journalism and all of it. I mean, so there's no question that it's inescapable. But I think one of the other issues, too, that we've talked about, and I'm sure your callers have questions on this as well, is this deal that I always talk about that fans make, especially when it comes to performance enhancers in baseball. On the one hand, you have this idea about purity and cheating and the rest of it, and then you have fans saying, look, steroids and PEDs is a media creation, and it's very interesting that you have the fans say, oh, you know, I don't really care who uses what, but at the same time, they do care. They care because the minute a player does get busted, you can see the difference in how they're treated. You can see the lineage, especially, I think it's generational. You've got this generational gap between kids who grew up in a steroid era watching baseball and people like us who are a little bit older who remember when this was not part of the game.
Let me get Elliot from South Philadelphia to join us, and I do want to talk about Alex Rodriguez. But first, Elliot, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're
Marty.
Welcome.
I'm an avid listener.
Thanks.
I've been listening all morning as usual.
Great.
I read Howard and William C. Roden all the time, and I watch them every Sunday on the Sports Reporters. These conversations are always interesting to me. I'm a kid who grew up down in South Philly in a project around the corner on the sports complex. My goal in life was to be like Charles Barkley and Herschel Walker, and obviously that didn't happen for me. But when we talk about the moral turpitude of players, from going back to as far as Ron Artest up to A-Rod today, we oftentimes, or to me, what never seems to get talked about is the moral turpitude of owners.
Mm-hmm.
If we hold players who are, by and large, in American sports, minority kids, from not well-to-do, not well-connected, working class at best backgrounds, and we hold them to a standard because of the money and the branding and the college scholarships that they get, so on and so forth, it seems to me a vast imbalance with regard to are never talking about well-connected, well-to-do, privileged billionaire owners.
Well,
and their moral ineptitudes or turpitudes.
Well, Elle, you raise a really good point, and I'm going to toss that first to you, Howard, but then to you, Art. Go ahead, Howard.
Agreed 100%, and one of the things that I try to do all the time is create that balance. You have to have that balance. We constantly blame the players. We constantly get on the players because they're the public face, and I think they're the easy ones. When you talk to the union guys, they always tell you that it's very easy to turn on players because the players won't always be there. Their careers are the short ones, and then they'll be gone, and no one likes to hold the owners accountable. And I think that especially in the steroid era when we're talking about baseball, that the owners had as much culpability as anybody in terms of opportunities to step in and do something. It was in their financial interest as well not to do anything. It may not have been in their financial interest to suggest that players use steroids, but it was certainly not in their financial interest to stop players from using. It's not in their best interest to do a lot of the things that they've done that have hurt the game. But I think the hard part for the fan is it's that deal that Art and I were talking about, is that if you turn on the owners, then where are you going to root? Because the difference between me and a fan is I write about this. This is my job. This is their entertainment. This is their fun. And that's the conflict here. It's like you're taking away something that I really enjoy, and I'm trying really hard to enjoy this. But I think the caller's question is absolutely right, and it's our fault as journalists that we have to hold ownership accountable. And the biggest reason why we have to do that, even though sometimes the fans don't let us, is that they're using your tax dollars, so they actually do owe you something, too.
Well, Elliot, I appreciate the call. Arthur, let me give you a chance to respond to that, and I guess in part because the public builds these beautiful stadiums used by these sports teams. But how do you see the role of the owners? And we have about a minute before our second break.
Well, I see them as setting the moral framework, and I think Howard's 500% right. If they didn't like performance-enhancing drugs in sports, they wouldn't be there. If the owners said, look, let's shape hockey up and cut back on the headshots and the vicious checking, that would end. I guess I'll give you a small example, Marty, just quickly.
Sure.
The owners don't do what they could to protect the health of the players. They hire doctors. They hire trainers. The game is to keep those guys out playing. The illusion is that they're working to protect the health of the athlete. But again and again, you know, if you keep too many people out as the doctor of the team, guess what? Next year, you're not the doctor of the team anymore. So it tells you something about where their orientation is as well.
And that's Art Kaplan, a professor, founding head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Langone, right.
Okay, good. In New York City, Howard Bryant also with us as well. Senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN The Magazine. We're talking about the ethical quandaries, dilemmas of being a sports fan. Elliot, thanks for the call. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
What's going on in your brain while you sleep, and how can you make sure you get the sleep you need? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with neuroscientist Penelope Lewis, author of The Secret World of Sleep. She runs the Sleep and Memory Lab at the University of Manchester in England. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Raids on pro-Morsi supporters in Cairo mark one of the bloodiest days in Egypt since the uprisings began.
It was the closest thing I've ever seen to a war zone. You've still got thousands of people in there determined to hold their ground.
A country deeply divided with an unclear roadmap for the future. Next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about some of the ethical challenges of being a sports fan, especially when you know about players using performance-enhancing drugs and lying about it, or committing crimes, or using racial slurs, or coaches abusing their players, or colleges failing to graduate their student-athletes, or owners and managers meeting out puny fines and punishments for bad behavior. Again, our guests are Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com, and Art Kaplan, a bioethicist at NYU. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499.
Hey, Marty, I have to say, I listened to that list you just read off. Yep. I think I'm taking my Eagles banner down as we speak.
Sorry about that. I know these sports fans are tearing.
I realize I wrote most of that list.
You did. I think I probably cribbed that from a lot of what a lot of people have been writing about, because it all seems to have come together over the last couple of weeks. Let me see what Nancy from Lafayette Hill has to say. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, and we'll talk about Alex Rodriguez.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
35 years ago, I had a mercifully brief career with the Philadelphia Daily News Sports Department. I've never particularly been a sports fan, but since I worked overnight, like 7 to 3 in the morning, I was utterly amazed at all the phone calls, and it was all about gambling.
Wow. You know that? Did you take some of those calls?
Yes. They wanted, because I was finding myself giving out scores and stuff, and the writers, I was an editorial clerk, so you can't do that. This is many years ago. But it was all, they all had money on these games. We got calls from Vegas, everywhere. It was all about money. And I was kind of turned off from that, and I've heard nothing to change my opinion since. I don't know whether that's relevant to what you're talking about now, but it's always something I've always been conscious of.
Well, let's find out. And Howard, you have written a lot about money in sports. What do you think?
Well, I'll add to it. I think she's 100% correct on this, is that let's not forget the baseline of football. There's a reason why there are line scores in football. There's a reason why there are the odds makers and the injury reports and all of that stuff is so important. That's because people are betting on this. And without gambling, football is nowhere near as popular as it is. And that's the same as the other sports, but football is essentially tailor-made for gambling. And so it's one day a week for the most part, although they're trying to make it almost every day now. But it's a gambling sport. And information is key, and how Tom Brady's knee is doing and whether he's going to play Friday night completely affects a line score. And it's the same, and you can add to that fantasy. Fantasy football is another form of gambling. And it's one of these different ways that the sport is expanded, and it's also one of the ways that sports is held to a higher ethical standard simply because you want the games to be on the level. The thing that I would say about it, too, is Art brought up the point that if the owners wanted to do something about whatever, whether it's performance enhancers or what have you, they would do it. In baseball, as we know, gambling is the death penalty. It goes back to Shoeless Joe Jackson and the Black Sox, mm-hmm. Pete Rose. Gambling, you gamble, you're gone for life. They have a conflict now with performance enhancers about that in terms of the ethics of it. One last thing I wanted to say with Art, too, when you brought up the conversation about the trainers. One trainer used to tell me when I was covering the Oakland A's, our job is not to get you healthy. It's to get you healthy enough to play.
Wow. I feel like I've seen that movie. Art, let me ask you about Alex Rodriguez and actually Pete Rose. I'm looking at a piece that you wrote recently for Forbes. The headline is, "If Pete Rose Stained Baseball, Alex Rodriguez Desecrated It."
Rodriguez is really, it's interesting.
And we should say he was suspended by Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig because of his alleged ties to this drug clinic, Biogenesis. But he's been playing.
Right, and he's an admitted user already, so these are new and more devastating charges because he's not only accused of using, he's accused, apparently, allegedly, of covering up and even destroying evidence. So it gets to be quite a mountain of a problem in terms of performance-enhancing drugs. Rodriguez, I'll just say this about him if listeners don't know. You know, he was a very, very good third baseman throughout his career. He's hit, what is it, something like 650 home runs, Howard, at this point?
He's 648.
So he's a major producer in baseball. He has Hall of Fame statistics, but he has constantly denied what he's doing. He's been fighting for the right to play, and the way the rules are written, he can, which is why he's out there right now playing, even though he's suspended. He's appealing. Yeah. And I think he represents, in some ways, what I was complaining about before. You want to believe that your athletes achieve what they do because they try hard, they work out, they exercise, they have virtue. And here's this guy who clearly, like many others who used from his era, achieved big numbers and big performance, and you have to wonder how much of this is due to cheating, how much of it is due to drugs. But what we want to fantasize about is that he's a good guy. He tries hard. He's skilled. And what we see is this horrific sort of unfolding saga that he's a cheat, a liar, deceptive, tries to get other people involved, covers up. It's the antithesis, if you will, of what you'd expect if you want to sell sports as virtue.
Go ahead, Howard.
My problem with all of this is the nature of selective justice that we go after Alex Rodriguez, because it is pile on time. He's 38 years old. His skills are not what they used to be. It would be a very different dynamic in terms of this Alex Rodriguez PED conversation if he were still hitting 330 and hitting 50 home runs and the whole thing as he used to. Baseball believes, many people in the commissioner's office believe, he's been using steroids his entire career, that his entire career has been steroid laden from day one in Seattle to today.
By the way, Marty, pile on that gambling comment question, which I think is very, very important. I could add in the NCAA men's college basketball championships wouldn't get the attention they do if we didn't have a national gambling day on them. But the
sport that appears to be taking
the toughest stance toward performance-enhancing drugs because of gambling is horse racing.
Just to add another sport to our conversation, Howard, did you want to finish?
I did. I was just going to say...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, it's fine. I was just saying that this notion of selective justice, that if the guy... We always say that, you know, steroids is the other team's problem. None of our guys. I remember during the whole steroid era thing, I had so many people from Boston saying to me, yes, but no Red Sox players were using, right? And so it is a selective justice conversation where this guy's a good guy, therefore we're going to let him off the hook. I mean, Mark McGwire has done more to damage Major League Baseball in the last 50 years than Alex Rodriguez ever could. Mark McGwire took the greatest record in professional sports, was on steroids, hugged Roger Maris's family, and then embarrassed himself in front of Congress. He's still working in baseball and never was sanctioned. So there's all kinds of conversations in terms of ethics, in terms of selective justice, in terms of the fans, and what... It's a very complicated time to be a sports fan, which is why I think most fans just say, you know what, give me the games, I don't care about the rest, don't mess with my fun and games. I had a hard week at work. I got a tough marriage or whatever. My kids are driving me crazy. I want to sit down and watch the ball game and leave me alone. And it's more and more difficult to do that.
Well, and let me just throw in a question, and a quick one to you, Art, and then I do want to get back to our callers. But this idea of apology, I was thinking of Lance Armstrong's sort of non-apology. And that seems to be the way people apologize these days.
The worst apology in the history of apologies, maybe, Lance Armstrong, just the worst, basically saying, you know, yeah, I did it, but everybody else did it.
Exactly.
And anyway, you know, it was just a horrible apology. I think apologies are good. You know, we try to tout them in medicine all the time. When there's an error or mistake, we say you should apologize, confess to your error, and so forth. But in sports, I think part of the way the apology is being used is to basically wipe the slate clean. It's not an admission of failure. It's saying, okay, I did something bad, forgive me, and let's move on. And that's not quite the way apology works.
But I would think, Howard, that sports fans would accept an honest, true, real apology, not a phony apology. But
they never get them.
They don't get
all because of all the layers that cover authenticity. And what are we apologizing for? I go to ball players all the time. I'm like, okay, you said X. Why are you apologizing for this? Well, because my agent told me that this is bad for my brand and the team's mad at me, and so there's all this pressure, and now I got to deal with it. And so essentially what they're saying is, okay, is this going to get you off of my back, even though what I said was completely true, even though I stand by exactly what I said, however, all of the different layers are forcing me to apologize, and the result is actually worse than just saying, yeah, I said what I said, deal with it.
Let me see what Lee from Marion Station has to say. Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, guys, and Marty. I don't know if you consider it a sport, but boxing is like the 800-pound gorilla in the discussion of violence and the love of violence. And I was listening this morning, and I think of that Dylan song, Who Killed Davy Moore, about the boxer who died in the early 60s. And he runs through the lists of all the culpable parties, from the fans to the boxing writer to the referee to the gambling man. And each one, you know, gives their empty justification for why it's not their fault that, you know, this fellow died in the boxing ring. But it's, you know, it's really, and there may be virtue in boxing or whatever sports, but there's also, you know, the vice of the bloodlust in there. And it just, I don't see how you cure that or, you know, purify it and still keep having that.
And I don't know if you heard
Lee,
this,
thanks
but
for the call.
Howard said mixed martial arts, which probably is, you know, worse, if anything, than boxing, just in terms of raw bloodlust, fighting inside a cage and so on. It, to me, the question is, boxing is basically dying, somewhat replaced by this other activity, but is that the future of football? I mean, in a way, you know, it's never been more powerful, more financially secure, the NFL and college football, the basic most popular sports in America, but if you have this concussion problem and damage to joints and all the rest of the injuries, if parents won't let their kids play, Harry Carson's comment, I'm not letting my son play, where's the future of the sport going to go? Is it headed toward where boxing went?
Well, exactly, and on top of that, you have so many different layers that go on top of football from an ethical standpoint anyway. I mean, one, I remember talking to Johnny Damon, who used to play for the Yankees and a bunch of other teams, and he said, I would never let my kid play football because if they've got enough athletic ability to play football, chances are they've got enough athletic ability to play something less dangerous. But this is also the deal. I get boxing from a historical socioeconomic standpoint. It's the way out story. It's the American capitalist story. And if your fists are your commodity, it's no different in a lot of ways than being a swimsuit model. This is what it takes. However, there's a lot of violence that comes with it for the money. The one of the reasons why boxing is dying is because the society is becoming more affluent. There are better, easier, less dangerous ways to make a living. Mm-hmm. And the question with football is going to be exactly that. Are there better, easier ways to make a living? We never even got a chance to talk about the NCAA and all of their hypocrisy.
No, no.
The big conversation with all of this, once again, is where you've got ridiculous resources and revenues coming in against the ethics of what we're actually watching. Art is right. We all have a responsibility to look at ourselves and say, okay, how are we contributing to it, especially when you're in the business like I am or like we are. There's no way around it. And we always say, okay, well, when somebody dies on the field in the NFL, then we'll get the picture. But guys have been paralyzed and committed suicide when their careers are over. It's entertainment with a really deadly undertow.
We haven't talked about women, and I think that's interesting. I don't know how significant that is, but let me toss that to you, Art Kaplan, because if we're talking about players behaving badly, we're largely talking about male players. We've been talking about sports largely played by men. Is there some kind of a gender difference? Does it have to do with money or just the way women approach competition?
Yeah, well, we have had our share of women performance-enhancing drug problems, certainly in track and field. We'll recall the old East German Olympic.
Yeah, and Marion Jones.
Marion Jones.
Right. So there are, but not at the level, I think, that we've been talking about with men's sports.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know what Howard thinks on this, but my view is women's sports have grown. They're very important, but they're just not at the level of the where men's sports are. They don't generate the gambling interest. They don't generate the media revenues. They're important, and certainly, as I said, as sexism dies down, women's sports begin to emerge. But they're just not on the same scale yet.
I agree, and I think that what ends up happening, I think you have the same pressures to compete when the money starts to rise. People talk about Serena Williams and Venus Williams and Samantha Stosur and all the great tennis players and whether they're on performance enhancers or not, or the great track and field athletes. You had a bunch of track and field of the track stars in Jamaica just get busted for PEDs a couple of weeks ago. So the pressures are the same. the ethics are the same. The difference is the actual overall revenues. And I think that what you find is that, you know, men and women are all in the same boat in terms of these ethical questions. If for every ball player who's getting involved in things they shouldn't be getting involved in, they're getting involved with women at, you know, at the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning who see an opportunity to be involved in the same dynamic money wise. So where there's a chance or where there's opportunity and stakes involved, you're going to have these same ethical questions.
Well, we have 30 seconds. Art, will you be watching the Eagles?
You know, undoubtedly I will, and I'm going to be watching it really with more and more mixed feelings because I know the toll that's going on out there, and to some extent I'm watching an illusion. But like Howard said, when Sunday rolls around and the cares of the week build up, you do want that entertainment escape, and at least that's the one I'm acculturated to. We'll see what happens with the next generation.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I feel like we should do this every week. Talk to both of you about sports. Art Kaplan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Howard Bryant, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Howard Bryant, author of The Last Hero, a biography of Henry Aaron, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, and he has served as sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Art Kaplan, professor and founding head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center in New York City, and he has served as an advisor to the International Olympic Committee and other sports bodies, written a lot about ethics and sports. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.